all that kind of good stuff. I'm ready to go. All right, good morning and welcome to PGCon 2010. My name is Gavin Roy and this is a talk on NoSQL and what it means to the Postgres community. So to start off, in case you guys haven't been following the NoSQL movement because you've been so focused on Postgres, which is completely understandable, there are a lot of words up here and I'm not going to read them. But what NoSQL generally is a database movement, an idea that we can scale out in large, high transaction volume websites primarily by ditching traditional database concepts and using some fairly old technology that's been rewrapped and used in new ways to scale out horizontally while sharding data and keeping data on multiple systems. And basically not running into the single server constraints of database systems or using multi-master replication in traditional RDBMS. It puts a lot of the onus on the developer. So when you're writing applications in a NoSQL environment, the developer is generally the guy that's dealing with the data. For DBAs, that's a pretty bad thing, right? But also for developers, it's not a great thing. When you change your schema and change your application, a lot of times in NoSQL databases, you have to take that into account in your code. So unlike your relational database system, where you've got a field and you make an alter table and now everybody's got that field, not so in NoSQL. You gotta be able to account for missing fields and new fields and all that kind of fun stuff. So what does NoSQL mean? It was originally coined, believe it or not, in 1998. It was the name of a system, and it kind of really just faded into obscurity. It really wasn't thought about until we started addressing the database scaling needs of large websites, things like Facebook and Twitter, Amazon, obviously people have heard of that, Google started thinking about these things, and so it was reintroduced in 2009. And basically, as these large web environment companies were trying to figure out, how do we scale MySQL primarily, right? And so they started looking in these other directions. But it's also better stated, even though there's NoSQL in NoSQL databases primarily, there are really no relationships between your data. They're key value stores. You're taking data and you're shoving it somewhere with a key and you're accessing it later. And really, as I mentioned, it's primarily about large-scale websites. So what's so new about it? I mean, everybody's talking about it. It's very trendy. It's all over, you know, Twitter. It's all over tech news areas. And it's using old technology. I mean, you can see primarily they're using key value stores like DBM, Berkeley DB, which was basically the way of getting out of the patent encumbering of DBM. So that's not new. Lotus Notes came out with the document-oriented database in the late 80s, right? But the use case is new. People weren't dealing with size and scale in the way that we deal with size and scale in the database world with regard to large-scale websites 10 years ago. Just wasn't something that we were thinking about. And this is primarily why. A lot of people, because of the way that the Postgres community is developed, the Postgres product is developed, and our focus on quality and you know, adhering to standards and addressing speed as we went, jumped on the MySQL bandwagon very early on. PHP plus MySQL, I know you guys have heard it. It is somewhat of the standard of how people thought about developing websites, And then all of a sudden, these sites got bigger and bigger and bigger. Facebook's a great example. Facebook grew and grew and grew. And how did they grow? They grew by partitioning their user data on different MySQL clusters. So if you went to Harvard, you had your own MySQL server. If you went to Berkeley, you had your own MySQL server. Well, that only scales so much, right? Because you got to partition these data out. And when you get billions of users or hundreds of millions of users, that doesn't work very well. So Memcache came around. Memcache is an in-memory database key value store daemon. There's no persistence. It's very fast. It's easy to scale out. It's a command line daemon with a couple switches, no config file. And Facebook, My Yearbook, where I work, other companies, Dig, we use it very, very heavily. It takes the brunt of the read load off of the database to the scale of 10 to 100 times the transactions. So for example, at My Yearbook, where our database servers do roughly 30,000 transactions per second, our Memcache servers are doing well over 300,000, closer to 400,000 transactions per second. And so some very smart guys were saying, hey, we're using MySQL, we're using Postgres, we're using Oracle, and we're sticking Memcache in front of it. And now our programs have to think about Memcache, they have to think about database. What happens if we can combine them? So that was the original promise of NoSQL, right? It was this idea that I no longer have to think about my caching layer and my database layer at the same time. I'm already dealing with key value store for Memcache. And so what happens if I can kind of push my database into that, right? So there were early efforts like MemcacheDB that basically took Memcache and the protocol, which is very simplistic, and they put persistence behind it. But the best use case scenario for NoSQL that I have found, the thing that makes the most sense to me, is the fact that these guys are scaling websites on commodity hardware. Joe Stump from Simple Geo, which is a new startup, they run entirely out of Amazon's cloud services, said it best, I think, in that his use case for NoSQL is basically cost. He is buying into the promise that using cloud-based services and using commodity hardware and NoSQL databases, he can scale out 50 nodes, I think he says, right? And he doesn't have to worry about that big database purchase. Now, see, I think that big database purchase is actually worth it. And I don't know if he's talking about my company or not, but we're in that range. And we are buying big, big hardware to run Postgres on. And it works really, really well. Now, one of the important things when we're talking about NoSQL is understanding the differences between Postgres, specifically, and NoSQL databases. And so about 10 years ago, Professor Brewer came up with this idea that there are constraints around how we deal with data when it gets partitioned across multiple database servers, right? And so he came up with what was called then Brewer's conjecture. And the idea was that you can, out of consistency, making sure your data is consistent, availability, making sure that your database server is available to answer queries all the time, and partition tolerance, having multiple nodes that are responsible for data, and if you lose one, still being able to get at that data, that you can't have all three at the same time, or at least you can't do it well, right? And so when we think about Postgres, So this goes a little bit into partition tolerance. So Seth Gilbert and Nancy Lynch came around and they said, hey, this is a really good idea. We're going to prove it. So they were at MIT, and they basically spent a lot of time making proofs for his conjecture, and that turned it into what we now know as the CAP theorem. And basically what they're saying here is if I have multiple nodes with my data and I lose one, that partition tolerance can't go away. I should be able to get at that data even if I lose multiple nodes. And that goes to what Joe Stump was saying about having commodity hardware and having 50 servers. The database system that he's using, Cassandra, actually has a really nice rebalancing protocol built into it that if you lose a node, you don't lose any data, and data starts getting moved around to different nodes. So Postgres focuses on consistency and availability within this concept, right? Our data is using MVCC, always consistent snapshots. It's using ACID from a concept standpoint to say that the data that I have in my database is always consistent when I ask for it. And it's available, right? But we don't really haven't branched out. We've been using third-party, you know, community-driven replication, Sloney, Langdiste, Bacardo, to ship our data around. And those things don't have this idea of partition tolerance, at least to a large extent, in the way that the NoSQL databases are thinking about it. NoSQL focuses on availability and partition tolerance. That means that they're very heavily focused on making sure the data is available everywhere. But the problem with that is the data can't be consistent immediately. And so what we're looking for is eventual consistency. I can make a change on one server, and after a delay of 10 seconds, it's made on another server. And if I have two clients accessing both nodes, they're going to get different answers. In the web world, in the Facebook world, that's okay. Do you really care if your friends go to look at your friends on Facebook and they both see two different lists for a very short period of time? It's not a big problem to have. So I wanted to use this as a little bit of a note. It gets cut off here. F-sync off. This is going to come up a little later. But something we can do in Postgres, right? We can basically say, Postgres, you know, do everything I'm doing, but you don't worry about the operating system, right? You can tell the operating system, here's the data, but don't make sure that the operating system writes it. And so database administrators, running with scissors, that's us in my yearbook. One of the ways that we make Postgres scale is we run with fsync off, and that's dangerous, and it's running with scissors, and it's bad. Everybody's going to tell you it's bad. But Postgres is a lot faster with it turned off, and we have redundancies set in place that if we lose anything, knock on wood, it's not a major deal. So Cassandra, who here has heard of Cassandra? It's probably the one that's the most talked about right now. It is what was developed at Facebook, and it's used by Dig, Twitter, multiple large websites. It's kind of a pain to develop for. I mean, honestly, in going through and setting it up, one of the interesting things about it is you define your schema to a degree within the configuration file. So if you want to change your schema at any point in time, got to change your configuration file everywhere. You know, it's pretty early on as a project, and it was really designed to do one thing for one company, and they said, hey, everybody, this is what we're doing. You can have our code, which is great. It's helping us out. And so the Apache Foundation came in, they made it an official project, and it's growing and growing and growing. So 2 years from now, who's to say where they're going to be with some of my gripes about it? One of the interesting things about it is they use a technology very similar to Postgres. You should all be familiar with the wall log. They use a commit log, which is very similar to the wall log in Postgres, to maintain durability. But they don't actually worry about durability when it comes to the data files themselves, just the write-ahead log. That's that idea of eventually consistent as things go across. Again, they focus on availability and partition tolerance. And they wrote their own protocol that they use for multiple things within Facebook. So Thrift, the protocol that they use, handles their log daemons and all sorts of things. And they made it work with their database as well. One of the interesting things about Cassandra, coming from a DBA perspective, somebody who writes queries, and you may have heard it before, Brian Aker made a really good point in one of his talks. Querying is MapReduce. Sorting is MapReduce. Grouping is MapReduce. If you want to query, sort, and group, it's MapReduce, MapReduce, MapReduce. So you're basically taking your data, you're running it through a filter that's giving you the outset of one set of operations, and then you're running through another filter that's doing it, and then you're running through another filter that's doing it. So that's Cassandra. CouchDB, who's heard of CouchDB? CouchDB has been around for a little bit. It's cool. It's written in Erlang. Erlang's a pretty neat language, you know, that high availability, distributed nature of the language. They tell you to relax. One thing that can set apart NoSQL database from everything else, you got to have a cool logo. And if you have a cool logo with a catchphrase like relax, that makes it even better. If you haven't used CouchDB before, actually when you start the daemon up, it says CouchDB is started. It's time to relax. There are two major deployments that I could find The BBC is in their case studies. They use it. And Engine Yard, the Ruby hosting company, uses it as well. It's a key value document store. And so the idea there is your document is defined in JSON. So your schema, your table, your row is a bunch is a JSON object with a bunch of attributes and values and a key. Its durability is append only. So they're writing their database out in an append only way. And it uses MVCC, just like Postgres, to make sure that your data is consistent. And it, too, focuses on availability and partition tolerance. It has some neat replication stuff built into it. The protocol was what originally attracted me to CouchDB to play with it. JSON via HTTP REST. So you're talking to your database via HTTP GET. I want to get this key. Put, I want to put this document. Delete, I want to delete this document. And I was talking about MapReduce. CouchDB is the same way. They actually have built-in functionality for MapReduce. So CouchDB embeds SpiderMonkey, the JavaScript engine, within the database server itself. And the equivalent of stored procedures are all written in JavaScript. And so, again, if you want to sort a bunch of documents, you develop a view and you want to sort the output, MapReduce. You want to query and only get a range of documents, MapReduce. And then you want to group those documents, you MapReduce those as well. Sounds like a lot of work to me. MongoDB. Who's heard of MongoDB? MongoDB, I consider the up-and-comer. It's really been getting more and more popular. It's not talked about as much. You can see they run with scissors by default. They run with fsync off, and part of the claims about speed about MongoDB, you know, it's really, really fast. Well, fsync off. Turn fsync on, it runs into the same constraints as everybody else. And they've been used in a couple places. One of their major wins, I consider, SourceForge. I don't know how many of you remember the history of SourceForge, but at one point they ran Postgres. The point before that, they ran DB2. Now they're running MongoDB. They rewrote their entire system for that. Foursquare uses it. Bitly uses it. GitHub uses it. And it's a key-value document store, just like CouchDB. Here's the catch-all, or the main problem. One of the core developers of MongoDB says, don't worry about durability. You can't have it on a single node. You can't run a single MongoDB cluster or a single MongoDB node server and have durability. You got to run multiple. In case that first one goes down, you got the second one, and hopefully your data's over there as well because they're eventually consistent. To me, that's a bit of a problem. And so one of those things that you actually have to judge. In-place updates, so as opposed to some of the other technologies that are using append-only logs to write data out, they're actually going back and using in-place updates. Unlike the other two that I've talked about thus far, they actually focus on consistency and partition tolerance similar to Postgres. They're not concerned as much about availability. They use binary JSON to store their data in the database, and you talked to the database via JSON. They wrote their own protocol for communicating with it, though. So unlike CouchDB, where you can use curl or whatever to manipulate your database, you actually have to use Mongo drivers. And then you're making your queries in JSON. So this should read as something familiar to everybody here. If you decided to jump into Mongo land, this is what you're writing. So for my database things, I'm going to find where my field J in my JSON document, that's not equals, by the way, dollar sign not equals, 3. And K is greater than 10. That's, to be honest, it's a little hard to write and deal with because I wrote an application using Mongo and I got a little frustrated trying to look up all the different dollar sign variables to do my queries. What's interesting about Mongo, though, is unlike everything else, you can actually do ad hoc queries, which adds some value to it. So here's another query. Pretty simple, right? You guys can read that. MongoDB land. I'm going to find all the records. I'm going to skip 10, and I'm going to limit 10. That one's not so hard. But it's interesting the way that they're chaining functions like that. It's very JavaScript-esque. OK, so I lied about the logo thing. Project Voldemort. was developed at LinkedIn. They don't have a logo, or at least one that I can find. I mean, I saw a V somewhere, but so I think that kind of ruins them out. Maybe we should, okay. It's a key value document store, and what is interesting about Voldemort is they actually say, we're not really focused on the database side of things. We're focused on the data, the hash ring that we're going to split our data around in. So we're going to rely on a pluggable database backend architecture. Does it sound familiar to anybody? MySQL uses a pluggable backend. So you get different behaviors depending on your different database backends. So by default, they use BerkeleyDB. It's pretty good. Works well. They also use MySQL. And there are a few other ones. They focus on availability and partition tolerance as well. It's written in Java. And they have multiple serialization formats for data. I say that they have their own communication protocol. They say that they support HTTP. They don't support HTTP. It doesn't work very well anyway. It's in its infancy as a project. It's used at LinkedIn extensively. And I really couldn't find anybody else that was using it, or at least talking about the fact that they're using it in a high-profile install. Redis. I assume people have heard of Redis. Really, we're moving somewhat away now from NoSQL traditional stuff to just key-value store. Redis is interesting. It's sponsored by VMware, so they actually pay people to work on Redis on a regular basis. It is a key-value document store. It's an in-memory database with durability via snapshots. So the way the system works is you do everything you're doing with the database, you're setting everything, and then somewhere at a given interval, a snapshot of that memory footprint is taken and it's written to disk. And that's their durability. They focus on availability and partition tolerance as well. There's no set serialization format. This is more like Memcache. This is basically a similar to a BDE, a Berkeley database implementation. It's a key and it's a value. What you put in the value doesn't matter to you, or to them anyway.
The values are sets, arrays, and hashes.
Yes. But as far as what you put in, I'm sorry?
That's Redis's distinguishing characteristic.
Okay. They have their own communication protocol. It's very similar to POP3. That was kind of fun to play around with. It's a neat little thin, lightweight server. I was mentioning logos as well. Tokyo Tyrant doesn't have a logo either. But it's a pretty cool system, and they run with scissors as well. You can actually grep. There is no fsync in the source anywhere within Tokyo Tyrant. It's both a key-value DBM implementation, and it's a daemon that runs on top of it. The key-value DBM implementation is actually Tokyo Cabinet, and it's a library, a set of utilities. You can actually link directly to the library if you want to do that instead of using their daemon. They use durability via wall and shadow paging. They focus on availability and partition tolerance. And again, there's no set standard for data serialization as far as what you put in and what you get out. What's interesting, though, is the protocol support that they had. So they wrote their own binary protocol, which is actually very similar to Memcache's text protocol. But then they also support Memcache text protocol. So at my yearbook, we've experimented with Tokyo Tyrant fairly extensively within a production environment to say, can we replace this particular key-value-oriented system as actually a redirect service that we use for our own content and just use Tokyo Tyrant? And I'm sad to say it was actually a failure. We went back to Postgres because of performance concerns at scale. So... But it is an interesting project. It is fast. And we just didn't have the time or energy or expertise, to be honest, to want to tweak and manage this particular service when we knew that we could go back to Postgres and do it very well. So I told you about how NoSQL kind of came about of this idea that we want to solve our scaling problems, right? We want to maybe get rid of the database component, kind of, by using the Memcache-like concept and just using key-value stores. It's not really a dirty secret because people talk about it, but they're still using Memcache in front of their tools Reddit, for example, just recently came out with a blog post talking about Cassandra and their use of Cassandra and their migration from MySQL to Cassandra, I believe. And they use Memcache in front of Cassandra. So they've got a key-value store database that's supposed to be highly scalable and fast, and they're running Memcache in front of it. Twitter also has said that they use Memcache in front of Cassandra. And Facebook just the other day, that doesn't have the date in it, 2 days ago, came out with a document in their engineering blog talking about how they power their social graph search. And Memcache sits in front of that. Business Insider uses MongoDB, and they use Memcache in front of it. Now, I think that that's interesting because it shows that while these concepts are good for what these people are doing, it makes business sense for them to be doing to using these NoSQL databases, it didn't solve that initial problem, at least yet, right? They're still having to think about read performance. Potentially, but if you're like Dig and you're rewriting 100% of your code base to use Cassandra, you know, and I couldn't find any mention of Dig. I actually think Dig themselves, I bring them up, say that they don't use Memcache anymore. So hard to say. It could be. That's one way to think about it. So all this leads to Postgres. And Peter Eisentrout came up with this, and I glommed on. I said it made a lot of sense to me. YesQL, Postgres is YesQL. How does it stack up? Postgres has been around for a long time. I put a little Easter egg in there that hopefully some people will recognize. You know, we've been growing Postgres as a community, as a product, for a long time now. Gosh, I want to say 13 years, somewhere in that range. And I was very fortunate to get involved with Postgres early on and use early versions of it. And at that time, I was coming from a DBA perspective and saying, I'm used to Sybase. I'm used to DB2. And I want a real database that has real database concerns and thinks about my schema first. I want date fields that work like date fields. I want integer fields that work like integer fields. I don't want to worry about the things that I would be worrying about with what was at the time. You know, they were all the open source relational databases were fairly young. And I think at the time my choice was between MSQL and Postgres. So how does Postgres stack up? I've watched Postgres as a project, as a community, as a piece of software grow over time. 9.0 is extremely exciting, and as a community, as a development team, you guys should be thrilled at what's coming out. Hot standby plus wall streaming is going to be huge. Probably one of the most requested features that we've heard as a community for years was built-in replication. And these two components build that replication in. We can scale it with horizontal partitioning, sharding data, thanks to the Skype guys. Really neat tool, PL Proxy. If you guys haven't looked into it, if you haven't attended one of their talks, please do. It's one of the foremost ways to scale Postgres. They put a lot of thought into it. It's a great product. It's helped us out at My Yearbook tremendously. It scales with hardware. Yeah, I showed you that slide from Joe Stump saying, I can get 50 commodity machines for a year for the price of one big server. One big server's cool. One big server running Postgres and running a high load with high transactional throughput is really cool. Yeah, I can run it on my 8-core machine, but if I can run it on a 48-core machine with, you know, half a terabyte of RAM, that's pretty neat. And it works well, right? I don't have the headache of running that 50-node cluster. I don't have to worry about machines going down. I don't have to worry about network management. I don't have to worry about network latency. I've got one box that's running well. Projects like PGPool 2 and GridSQL are other ways that people are scaling Postgres. Postgres XC looks exciting. There's a talk at PGCon about Postgres XC. I would attend. I'm going to attend. I hope you guys do as well. We'll see where it's going. I don't know a lot about it. What the promise is interesting of multi-master replication built into Postgres. Will that make it back into the main Postgres branch? I don't know. Probably not. But it is interesting. Connection pooling is another way that Postgres scales. If you're not aware, every connection to a Postgres backend daemon adds overhead to your performance. So on a high transaction website, a high velocity website, the fewer connections to Postgres that you can make, the better off you are. And again, the Skype guys wrote PG Bouncer. Really, really good tool. It's a thin, lightweight proxy that reduces the number of connections that go into your Postgres database. Key to scaling Postgres. Can't reiterate that enough. Anecdotally, at my yearbook in 2007, we decided we were going to get a monster box. We were going from an HP DL585. I don't remember the model number, but it was an 8-core box with 16 gigs of RAM. And I went to all the major hardware vendors, and I said, I want your biggest box that I can get in the x86 market. And what I ended up with was a Sunfire 16-core box with 128 gigs of RAM and direct attached storage. And I threw Postgres on, and we were benchmarking, and it really wasn't working as well as I wanted. And so I called up somebody, Josh, actually, and I said, Josh, what am I doing wrong here? You know, I got this really killer hardware. He worked at Sun at the time, so it was okay for me to kind of hit him up for this. What do I got to be thinking about? And he said, well, did you think about connection pooling? And I said, no. And it was the night and day difference on that hardware. It was actually amazing how much impact that makes. And, of course, Postgres scales with replication. So I talked originally about what's coming out in 9. But there is an existing suite of tools by people who have been trying to solve the scaling problem with using Postgres for years. And they're all worth looking at. They're all worth playing with and figuring out what works well in particular environments. So the myth that relational databases don't scale is just that. And I think my yearbook proves that. I mean, we have a very high transaction environment. We have a fairly small cluster of database servers, roughly 30 to 35. With warm standby failover dedicated equipment for each one of those boxes. That's not a significant investment for, we're one of the top 25 most trafficked sites in the United States. So we get more traffic than apple.com, we get more traffic than amazon.com as far as page views are concerned, and that's running Postgres. So Postgres does scale. So in sitting down and thinking about this, what does Postgres mean, or what does NoSQL mean to Postgres? I decided to write a very bad benchmark suite because I couldn't find any benchmark suites that really did what I was concerned with as far as this is concerned. And I didn't find any benchmark suites that said, hey, I want to talk SQL, and I want to talk NoSQL, and I'm going to talk it to all these different backends. So I wrote a very simplistic and, again, bad benchmark suite called KVP Bench. It's available on GitHub if you want to go see it. And I benchmarked on my desktop machine. So, you know, not terribly impressive hardware to run benchmark on, and definitely not the most ideal scenario. Right? My database servers were not detached from my client code, for example. But some interesting things came out of it. Let's see if we can move forward here. So what I did was I got the Supreme Court decision data. It's publicly available data. It's about 100,000 rows. You know, roughly 500 megs plus, depending on which database is storing the data. And I use the default configurations for every product that I've talked about, including Postgres, with a caveat on Postgres, which is I ran it with fsync on and I ran it with fsync off. The load test, there are two tests within the benchmark suite. There's a load test, and it's individual writes. So I took all that data, instead of doing what I would do in a normal environment and copying that data into the database to use it, I just did insert after insert after insert to say, how long will inserting these 98,000 rows of data take in all these different systems? And then there's also a random work one, which is 75% read, 25% read-write. Just kind of a gut thing, and that read-write is basically an update. And what I tried to do was use the same methodology across every product because some of the products don't allow for sets of overwriting pre-existing data in one command, the equivalent of the SQL update command. You actually have to go out and get the data, change your data, and then set it. I only used 10 backends, so I wasn't terribly focused on high concurrency, at least within this stage. It'd be interesting to go back and do that later, and I'll probably blog about that. And I did 10,000 queries per backend. So 100,000 queries altogether against these in the benchmark. So I tested the latest and greatest of every one of these. This is here mainly just for going back and understanding what was tested. And the results were interesting, to say the least. From a raw data perspective, Postgres with fsync off outperformed everything on the read test, or on the random work test. On a bulk load test, Mongo beat the pants off of everybody else. But it wasn't, you know, that bad of a race. Here's Mongo here, and you can see Tokyo Tyrant and Redis over here. And you know, Postgres is mixed in there. This outlier is CouchDB. And for the random workload test, Postgres is a key value store, so just two fields, key and value, outperformed everybody. So we have here, and then we have Redis here. Over here we've got MongoDB. You can see these are very close. I mean, we're talking half a second to a second difference between these. And again, you know, not trying to disparage the CouchDB guys because I think it's an interesting project. CouchDB was the dog here. It really didn't perform well. But second to that, Postgres with fsync on. Fsync on, fsync off. That's an interesting thing to think about. How much time the database is spending telling the operating system to make sure that the data is written to be consistent. Yes? I did not for this. I'd be happy to go back and do so. I spent probably about 20 hours altogether working on the benchmark and all that, and I didn't get to do as much as I would have liked. But, you know, time being what it is. So, ESQL. You know, I have to say, out of all the open source communities I participate in, and I know I find the most satisfaction out of seeing what's become of the Postgres community. Really talented developers. It's not just one talented developer. It's not two talented developers. You know, outside of the core team, you have the major contributors. I have a high amount of respect for the community and the amount of talented technical people that come to the table to contribute. It's unlike most other projects. I can think maybe Linux, but there's a lot of corporate support in the Linux world. You don't really see as much major contribution as you do to Postgres. It's also, you know, it's a mature code base. It's been around, as I said, over 10 years. It's stable. It runs in production in governments, in companies, individuals. You know that you can count on it, which makes it an interesting proposition when you're thinking about building those highly scalable databases, and how does it compare against a MongoDB? MongoDB is a newcomer. It's been around for a year, maybe two. It's got a company that's behind it, that's building it, that is developing an open source community around the product. But do I really trust the code base 100%? I have to say, personally, no. I don't run mission critical data in any of the tests that I've done with MongoDB. And unlike the reputation that was poorly earned, I think, about Postgres. Early on, in the late 90s, about Postgres being slow. That's just not true. Postgres is fast. I've shown you with my bad benchmark that Postgres is faster if you treat apples to apples with the NoSQL databases than the NoSQL databases, right? Wasn't the promise that it was going to be fast? MongoDB comes the closest. Cassandra, I was actually surprised, was not as performant as MongoDB. But Postgres performs really, really well. And not only that, it's got a well-documented code base, and the product, the interfacing with it, the query language, that's all very well documented. When I was researching Project Voldemort, the documentation is sparse. Figuring out the HTTP protocol, for example, I couldn't do it. I went into the Java code to try and reverse engineer how the protocol worked. There's no documentation on the protocols. There's no documentation on how to interface with it. There's up and running documentation. You know, here's how you do the basics. That doesn't get you very far. There is a dedicated team of people within the Postgres community that makes sure that everything is documented and it also is translated. You know, you're not getting that with these other databases. So that's important. It's important from a new user adoption perspective, and it's important from a, you know, it's 3 in the morning and my database is broke, how am I going to fix it perspective. And as I mentioned, it performs as well as or outperforms NoSQL databases. Do I think that that means that Postgres is going to solve every problem that the NoSQL community is trying to solve with their various projects that they're doing? No. I mean, Cassandra is very interesting for a couple of reasons, one of which is this idea of being able to lose a database server and not lose any data. That partition tolerance of the CAP theorem. And whether you agree with the CAP theorem of being 100% accurate or not, it's the best thing we got going right now to talk about these concepts. And so, you know, it's an important touchstone to think about. Can I run a high performance, high transaction environment Postgres cluster and, you know, using Postgres XC, using Bocardo, and lose a node and not lose any data? Something to think about. And so with that, are there any questions? Yes?
You use a lot of management software kind of around, so you have conventional consistency system for instance, and you need to know kind of, not necessarily that it's all consistent this time, but kind of the gap you know, between servers and whether that's kind of exceeding expectations or growing.
I think that makes a lot of sense to trend and analyze and alert on. I think that area, like the NoSQL kind of thrust in development direction is very immature right now. I didn't see a particular, I would imagine if you asked that question on a list, for example, the Cassandra list, it might be write a plugin that works with Nagios or write a plugin that works with Cacti. I don't know of anything offhand. No, I think it's really bleeding edge. The Mongo gives you a lot more information out of the box than Cassandra does, for example. There's a web interface, pretty dry web interface that's just got some internal stats that you can pull out and look at. But as far as the software itself, you know, nothing jumps out and says, this is you know, what you're running and this is where you're at. It may be there, to be honest. For example, in Cassandra, you know, definitely a novice. It's not something that I've run in production. It's only something that I've toyed with from an R&D perspective. If I could answer that, I probably wouldn't be standing up here, right? Different operatings. Different database or different operating systems have different strategies to make fsync faster. But ultimately, it comes down to what Josh said, which is you're waiting for a guarantee from the operating system that the data that you've asked to be persisted has been persisted. And that's the bottom line. Sure. Right. Which is a problem unto itself, right? How do you take the wall archiver or the wall log and parallelize it, right? When you're using the thing to guarantee consistency, and now you're using 10 processes, for example, 10 threads, to write that data out? How do you guarantee that that's working the way you want it to? Yes.
I would never run the testing off, but have you had any experience with battery-backed RAM acting as this partition for your wall file? Like, if you have lots of hardware budget, it seems to me you could almost get the benefits of fsync off, but the safety of fsync on.
Sure. No, we've played with that. We RAID cards and that sort of thing that are battery-backed. For us, again, knock on wood, we haven't had any problems. I'm not advocating going out and doing so. And there are definitely ways that you can engineer around it, for sure. But from a performance standpoint, it has been one of those things that's key for us. And we're not running financial transaction data, right? We're not running election data. And so from our perspective, you know, if we have a failover where we lose 2 to 5 minutes worth of data because we lost a machine and all we have is the last segment that was shipped over to our warm backup server, that's okay. That's not the end of the world in a social network. So it's a, you know, weighing out your problems and your architectures. All right, well, thank you very much, and I hope you guys enjoy this conference. I'm looking forward to a lot of the talks, and see you around. Yeah.
Now I think it's working. Okay, folks, this won't take very long, but it has information that you'll really, really want to know. Welcome to the Postgres Conference. I'm your host, Dan Langell.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan. Thank you. We're going to discuss a few internet protocols, which you'll probably want to know. GU Ottawa, if you're on the wireless, that's the one you should be using. You can get into this building up until about 11 o'clock at night, and if you're in here then, you can stay all night if you want. but the doors get locked at 11. The wireless will work until Friday at about 6 p.m. or so. If you're going to tag anything, your photos, your tweets, anything like that, use PGCon or PGCon 2010. There's an IRC channel on Freenode, and there's a PGCon group on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, please join. We had a flood of people come in since I announced that earlier this week. Food. The hallway by registration, the food will be there on a table at 12:30. Wear your badge. I'll be watching. You don't have a badge, you don't get food. Starbucks is right out here. It closes at 3 p.m.
What? Because it's summer hours for the school.
Okay. There's a second cup just down the road. Okay. The map. Starbucks, second cup, it's all on the map. If you don't know where the map is, go to the website, follow the links. The map has everything you need to know. You don't have to refer to anything else. There are three buffs. Tomorrow, starting at 6 p.m., one is on cluster hacking, one is on testing, the other one is on... No one wants another one. Okay. The map. There's a Google map. You can walk to everything. You can walk to anything you'll ever need around here. The market's just 5-minute walk down there. The social evening, the social event tonight is, 10-minute walk. It's on the map. It's a DB Enterprise evening. It's going to be dinner and drinks. It's at 7 p.m. You get at least half an hour to duck back to your room, drop off your laptop, change into your formal wear, and walk down. On Saturday, who's not leaving until Saturday afternoon or later? All right. If you've never been to Ottawa, we have more museums than we have politicians. They're all around the city. There's a couple who came up together for BSG Cannes, and I was talking to them last night, and they've literally been to all the museums I was going to suggest they go to. Just within walking distance, there's Parliament Hill. There's the NAC that you can go and look at. There's currency museum. Just search for museums on the map. Yes. Yeah, it opens this weekend. It's just over the canal, further down. It's filled with fossils, not the politicians. It has huge... It's basically been redone, and it's opening this weekend. It's been under reconstruction for about 10 years. You can provide feedback on all the talks through the schedule. You can provide feedback on any of the talks through the schedule. Find the talk you're in. Find the link to the feedback and provide feedback. We get to see that, and the speaker gets to see that, but they don't know who said it. Closing session, tomorrow afternoon, last thing, before the buffs. There will be an auction. The BSG Cannes conference last week raised $875 for charity. It goes to the Ottawa Mission, which is just up the road. They provide shelter and food for people. We, instead of giving away the swag that the vendors give us, we auction it off. The highest selling items last week were the Manga Guide to Databases and the Manga Guide to Statistics. Together as a pair, they sold for $260. Josh will have a sweatshirt of the 9.0 logo.
Signed by
25 of the top Postgres contributors. We've got some stuff from various vendors that we're going to auction off. Bring cash. Cash is better. It's easier for us to give away to the mission. But if you give us a check, I'll deposit the check and then give them the cash. U.S. and Canadian is a lot easier for us to deal with. Your tote bags. If you don't want your tote bags, don't throw them away. Give them back to us and we'll donate them to the food bank. That's about it. Any questions?
Where's the map?
The map? pgcon.org, Jan. Sorry?
I don't see anything
on about which? Oh, if you go to the schedule, it tells you the name of the room that it's at. It's Velvet, the Velvet Room, and then that's on the map.